The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
The House managers are outright lying about Trump, and I have the tapes to prove it. Plus, Governor Cuomo's M.O., first he kills him, then he hides the bodies. And the French come out against woke culture. Ooh la la. This is the Dinesh D'Souza podcast. Hey, I hope you subscribe to this podcast. I hope you like it. I hope you share it. Help me get the word out. I really appreciate it. This podcast is sponsored by MyPillow. I want to talk to you about MyPillow and how it's totally changed my wife Debbie's sleeping habits. When Debbie started using Mike's pillow, she began sleeping all through the night because of that change of life. She tried everything else and nothing worked until she found MyPillow and Mike's wonderful pillow. She also has a body pillow. The cool thing is these pillows don't go flat. You can wash and dry them as often as you want and they keep their shape. They're made in the USA. For a limited time, Mike is offering these premium pillows for the lowest price ever, a queen-size premium MyPillow for $29.98. It's regularly $69.98, so that's $40 savings, and the King pillows are only $5 more. You get the lowest price ever, again, $29.98 for the queen-size premium with the 60-day money-back guarantee. Go to MyPillow.com and use the promo code Dinesh. You get deep discounts on all Mike's products, Giza Dream Bed Sheets, the MyPillow Mattress Topper, and MyPillow Towel Sets. Call 800-876-0227 or just go to MyPillow.com. Don't forget to use promo code Dinesh.
America needs this voice. The times are crazy. In a time of confusion, division, and lies, we need a brave voice of reason, understanding, and truth. This is the Dinesh D'Souza Podcast.
Silence is always very revealing. One of the things I've learned both in literature and in political philosophy is to look for the significance of silence. It's often very telling. There's a great scene in Plato's Republic where Socrates is convincing Glaucon, his interlocutor, that it is wrong for Greeks to enslave other Greeks. And this is not easy to do, but Socrates goes through it. It's a long argument. Eventually, Glaucon kind of reluctantly concedes and goes, Glaucon says, well, yeah, okay, I agree that Greeks shouldn't enslave other Greeks, Socrates, but what about barbarians? Surely we can enslave those guys. And Plato says that to this, Socrates responded with silence. Why? Because Socrates realized, I've gone about as far as I can go, at least in this conversation. To try to go further is to risk the gains that I've already made with Glaucon. So the silence is very telling. It's an expression of prudence. We also see that that Lincoln was silent. Lincoln was virtually silent in terms of his public statements for 3 months. He was elected in November of 1860. He didn't take office until March of 61. In those days, there was a longer gap. And during this time, secession was gathering momentum, gathering steam. But what did Lincoln say about it? Nothing. It's almost as if Lincoln was quiet. He was assessing the situation. He was assessing the fiber of the American people. He was looking to see if they were ready for the days ahead. He was also assessing his own options. This is all very significant now because if you think about it, there is someone who is dead silent right now, and it's Trump. What's Trump saying? Nothing. He's quiet. And it's an eerie silence after all we heard from Trump over the last 4 years. Why is Trump silent? Worth thinking about. I'm not entirely sure myself. I'm thinking about it. Trump said in an interview, I believe with Larry King several years ago, that it would be very interesting for him, he said, as a thought experiment, for him to lose all his money. Because he goes, if that ever happened, He goes, I'd know who my true friends were. In other words, if I lose all my money and people aren't dependent on me, they're going to come out of the closet, so to speak. I'm going to be able to figure out their true character. And I wonder if one of the reasons for Trump's silence, apart from obviously assessing his options, is also to figure out who his allies are. And it's proving to be a pretty revealing sight if you look around the landscape today. Now, let's turn to the House managers and to the impeachment, the Senate trial. The House manager pressing their case. And they're doing it with the kind of whipped up enthusiasm. They're trying to turn small things into big things. Oh, look at this hallway. There's a Trumpster in the background. Look at his flag. Look at what he's wearing on his T-shirt. They're trying to create this sense of frenzy, of danger, of violence, of insurrection, of terrorism, of riot. But watching it, the videos don't even support that. You're looking there and you're saying, I don't see an insurrection. I don't see a coup. These people were there for what, 30 minutes? And then they got out? Is that a real coup? I don't see the terrorism. I don't see the insurrection. I don't see the coup. All I see is rowdy people pushing their way through hallways. Well, those of us who speak on the campus, who are familiar with activists who occupy the president's office and kick over his waste paper basket and start peeking through his papers, this happens on campuses, I won't say every day, but every other day. This is routine. And by the way, in an age of political protest, it happens all over the place. Think about something like Occupy Wall Street. What was their idea? Go occupy Wall Street. Shut the place down. Make a statement. Confront those guys. This is what that whole movement was all about. Now, as we watch the theatrics of the House managers, theatrics that, by the way, are going nowhere, but nevertheless, this is a kind of heroic effort. I say to myself, couldn't they have made a much better argument? What is the one thing that's in everybody's mind while we're watching them? What's in everybody's mind is, what about the far greater violence that we've been seeing on television and even around us for months? Wouldn't it be smarter for the House managers to admit, guys, you know what? We acknowledge that there's been a lot of political violence in America. We acknowledge that people have taken over courthouses and set fire to churches, and they have accosted people in dining in outdoor restaurants. We acknowledge that there's been Antifa and there's been Black Lives Matter, so that we think, however, that violence is not as bad as the violence that occurred in the Capitol. Why? Because this is the seat of government. You can see the argument could go two or three different ways, but the basic idea here would be to distinguish, try to make an attempt to separate the violence from the left with the violence from the so-called insurrectionists. So the question is, why are the House managers dead silent on this critical topic? Why have they said nothing about it, pretending like it doesn't exist, and thus crippling their own argument? Because that is the, you may almost call it, elephant in the living room. That's the dog that hasn't barked. That's what on everybody's mind. And here's why they can't do it. Because it's not simply a matter of them saying that there's violence from the left and the right, but everybody knows that the left incited the violence. The left used it. They defended it. They put up bail money for it. They apologized for it. They called for it to continue, in the words of Kamala Harris. In other words, violence is part of their playbook. And if you look at the left and the Democrats' position, their real position is something like this. Violence is good when it happens from our side, but it's bad when it happens from your side. We get to do it. It's part of our playbook. But we're going to make sure it's not in your playbook at all. Now, obviously, the House Democrats can't say that. But that is, in fact, the truth of the matter. That is their actual position. They are the inciters, accusing a man, Trump, who didn't incite anything, of being an inciter. And that's why their silence on this critical topic is perhaps the most telling thing of all. If you know the D'Souzas, we're very selective with our partnerships, and Eggert Watches is a company we are excited about. The CEO, Ilan, is an immigrant entrepreneur, American success story. His company creates exceptional products, but Ilan also cares about American values and has his own voice. Debbie and I watched some of his powerful videos on the Eggert website recently. You should check them out. What is Freedom is the first short film you'll see posted there. Ilan put his company on the line to take a stance on current issues like censorship facing America. Especially today, it's refreshing to see a business take a stand on principle. It's not the first time they've done it. Ilan was awarded the Fox Patriot Award after he stood up for the police, releasing a film during the Defund the Police movement called Speak Truth. Finally, Ilan made a video celebrating men called What is a Man in response to Gillette Corporation painting a picture of toxic masculinity in American culture with a recent ad campaign. Again, all these videos can be accessed on the front page of their website. Most important, Eggert makes incredible watches. Debbie and I are actually both wearing one today. Check mine out right here. And just look at the detail. Just look at what a cool watch this is. The craftsmanship, the uniqueness is something really to marvel at. They feel a lot more expensive than they are. Ilan is offering us a discount of 15% to pass on to you. You just have to use the promo code Dinesh at checkout. So now you have two reasons to visit EGARDwatches.com. Come for the watches, stay for the conservative films. There is a lot of complaints in the media that Republican senators are not taking, that they haven't been taking this House manager presentation of the evidence seriously. Of course, the comical extreme of this was Josh Hawley basically going into the lounge, leaving the room, kicking up his legs and reading, quote, unrelated material, which I think is fantastic. It shows that he recognizes that the whole thing is a circus and a farce. But other Republican senators are now taking pretty much the same approach. They stroll out of the room. They kind of skip out. It's kind of like they've already gotten the picture. And it may seem at the first glance that these people are being sort of cavalier about it or that they're not being impartial jurors. It's kind of funny. CNN had an article recently talking about three senators met with the Trump team before. They're supposed to be impartial jurors. Wait, are the Democrats impartial jurors? So many Democrats came out before the Senate trial, basically talking about the need to convict this man. So once again, you have CNN sort of with a straight face, you know, talking about the Republicans aren't impartial jurors, while they don't expect the Democrats to be impartial jurors at all. And neither, of course, is CNN and covering the trial. But the point to make here is that the Republicans have had enough. And the reason they've had enough is they've heard one brazen lie after another. And I'm not just talking here about the kind of rhetorical inflation, the Himalayan extension of the meaning of words so that suddenly a bunch of people walking through a hallway becomes a coup. A bunch of people who push their way through a door becomes an insurrection. A bunch of people who pull down who break a window become terrorism. So all this kind of comical exaggeration aside, there are one factual lie after another being presented with a straight face. So let's do three of these in this segment. I'm going to start with Ted Lieu talking about how the Trumpsters murdered a police officer.
We're all aware that a violent mob murdered a police officer.
So there it is. He's talking about Officer Brian Sicknick, and he's stating, as something we all know, a fact, that the Trumpsters murdered Sicknick. Except, it is already known now that that is not true. It is already known that Sicknick was not murdered. He was not hit on the head with a fire extinguisher, as had been widely reported. I mean, reported by not just the New York Times, the Washington Post. It was picked up by all kinds of other outlets. National Review was all over. They murdered a police officer. And this was the narrative that has shaped the hysteria But it turns out that it's a false narrative because the details of Officer Sicknick have now been coming out, and turns out they've been coming out in kind of a creepy way. It seems like even his family wasn't even properly informed. Officer Sicknick, by the way, did not die on January 6th. He went home on January 6th. He communicated with his brother. In fact, he said he was, quote, fine. Now, he died the next day, apparently the evening of January 7th, and they're trying to figure out what happened to him. Did he inhale some kind of pepper spray that he had an adverse reaction to? Did he have some pre-existing medical condition that acted up that caused his death? This is not known. But what is known is that this was not a deliberate or intentional murder. So this is a flat-out lie, and one has to assume a knowing lie. And the reason Ted Lieu can get away with it is he knows that people like the New York Times will go along with it. Why? Because they were accessories to the lie in the first place. Now, I noticed in a recent New York Times article, they talk about Sicknick in a different light. No, he wasn't murdered. They're trying to figure out the cause of his death. You'd think the New York Times would print a correction, would apologize for its previous misstatements. Nothing of the sort. They act like we never said anything different. Hey, we're just doing reporting here, guys. So this is the era we live in which brazen lies are offered, they're never corrected, and we just march along as if nothing really happened. No accountability whatsoever. And I now want to turn to Joaquin Castro, who puts out lie number two. Listen.
But can you imagine telling your supporters that the only way you could possibly lose is if an American election was rigged and stolen from you?
And you could have the election stolen from you.
And ask yourself whether you've ever seen anyone at any level of government make the same claim about their own election.
And you could have the election stolen from you.
So, you know, you can see the refutation kind of right there in the clip, but that's not the full refutation. I mean, just think of the total atmosphere of 4 years of questioning the legitimacy of Trump's election. I mean, this started before he was even elected. It reached a kind of feverish temperature right after Election Day, and it continued all the way through 2020. A widespread mass denial of Trump's electoral legitimacy from the left on all kinds of fronts. Hillary's statement is only sort of, you may say, the tip of this iceberg. And yet, here's Joaquin Castro with a straight face, as if there's nothing to be explained, nothing to be taken into account, no double standard to be resolved, none of that, with a straight face. Never before in history has anyone... So this is the Democrats of today. It calls for citizens like us to be extremely vigilant because these lies are just flying all around us. And now I take a third example. This involves Eric Swalwell, who, in an attempt to prove that Trump was endorsing violence, talks about a woman that Trump retweeted. The woman's name is Jennifer Lynn Lawrence. She's a California activist. According to Swalwell, she tweeted out that she was, quote, bringing the cavalry. And this is what Swalwell says about that. He goes, "We are bringing the cavalry. That was the consistent message. President Trump was inciting something historic. The cavalry was coming." Now, here's the only problem. That's not what Jennifer Lynn Lawrence tweeted. She actually tweeted, "We are bringing the Calvary." Calvary. Get it? It's a Christian reference. It refers to the place where Christ was crucified, on Calvary. And what Lawrence, who's a Christian activist, was referring to is her group was organizing a prayer vigil in Washington. This was the Calvary that she was talking about. "We are bringing a team of, quote, prayer warriors who are going to get together to pray for a resolution of this matter." So even though Lawrence spoke about Calvary, what Swalwell did, either deliberately or perhaps unintentionally, but it's hard to believe that he would in an impeachment trial with so much preparation, so many eyes looking on this, that he wouldn't intentionally be switching Calvary. And it's very easy to do. I almost misspoke myself a moment ago, to cavalry. So a statement of peace, of prayer, of an appealing to, you may say, a higher form of justice, is now converted into a false call for violence, a deliberate, perhaps, misinterpretation intended to create a false impression. So you can see now why the Republicans, who they may not be onto all of this, but they're onto enough of it, go, we've had enough. These are brazen liars. They've been lying now for the better part of a week. And why don't we send them with their tail behind their legs back to the House where they belong? Got problems with the IRS? I got to tell you about a time not so long ago when the big bad U.S. government tried to make an example out of me. And I know firsthand the importance of having proper representation to protect your freedom as well as your finances from being taken by the IRS. Ryan Danica and the Christian folks at South Coast Tax will discuss your unique situation and create a tailored framework of how to attack the situation head-on with the IRS and allow you a true fresh start. South Coast Tax has a settlement average of 3 cents on the dollar, or 97% reduction rate, along with an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau. With 20 years of experience alone, Ryan told me that he has yet to see a tax situation that has stumped him, and that's pretty impressive considering the size of the tax laws. Call Ryan at 800-TAX-3156 or check out their website, southcoasttaxresolution.com, and you'll see for yourself it will be the best move you ever made and the first step and getting your financial freedom back. That's 800-TAX-3156. I think the biggest problem that the left has with us is that we are onto them. We don't buy into their nonsense, their cockamamie arguments, their rhetorical foolishness, their false analogies, their brazen lies. We're onto them. And so we don't go along. We might listen. We might even be cowed into a certain kind of subjection, but we don't concede. I think it was Milton who says in Paradise Lost, who conquers by force had conquered but half his foe. We refuse to give assent, and that's what drives these people nuts. Right now, the Republican Senate is refusing to give assent to the House manager's case. And this is driving the media and the left nuts. I want to look at two examples of this. This is David Frum. David Frum, an old buddy of mine. I've actually had dinner at David's house. I know his wife. We were old friends going back to the my days in Washington, D.C. But David Frum is was started out as a libertarian. He's become a leftist. He was always looking to make a name for himself, and I think he's found a way to do this. He's a regular writer now for The Atlantic. And here's his article. There's no defense, only complicity. And I'm struck by the sort of dichotomy here. There's no defense for Trump, only complicity. If you don't buy into what the House managers are saying, you are complicit. You are actually an accessory. You are part of the crime. So let's follow Frum's logic here. His logic here is this. He goes, the remorseless, crushing power of the House manager's evidence, all backed by horrifying real-time audio and video recordings, shuttered any good faith defense of Trump on the merits of the case. Stop right there. This is nonsense. Trump has no smoking gun on incitement. He never called for people to storm the Capitol. The fact that they did that, or some of them did that on their own accord, in no way proves that Trump made them do it. So simply juxtaposing images of Trump's speech, his rhetoric, boilerplate as it is, actually much less intemperate than things the Democrats say every single day. So that makes no sense. Then he goes, the constitutional defense was rejected by 56 senators, not least because it defies a quarter millennium of federal and state precedents. This is another factually false and ridiculous statement. There is no quarter millennium of a record that consistently falls on one side. If there were, you wouldn't have a whole slew of distinguished jurists from J. Michael Luttig to Ken Starr to Alan Dershowitz to many others who say that Trump did have and does have a strong constitutional defense. So the point here is this is the obligatory David from blah, blah, blah that these days we've come to expect. But what strikes me is this assumption, no reasonable person can disagree, and therefore you have to be complicit. And here's Hillary Clinton. I'm quoting her. If GOP senators don't convict, it proves the jury, quote, includes his co-conspirators. Now think of the statement here. If you are a jury, and let's say you're, it doesn't matter if you're right or wrong. Let's say you're the OJ jury. And you're the OJ jury that for whatever reason refuses to convict OJ Simpson of murder. Okay, you're wrong. He did do it. But does that make you a co-conspirator? Does that mean you did it? You're part of the group that did it? No. A jury doesn't have to decide the right thing in order to vindicate itself on the charge of co-conspiracy. So this is the point I want to make that shows how far the left is going here. They're trying to intimidate Republican senators in effect into saying, if you don't vote with us, you are part of the crime itself. Today, we're in a battle for truth, and I'd like to recommend an insightful book to you called Reflections on the Existence of God by bestselling author Richard Simmons III. He writes on topics like life, death, sex, truth. Reflections on the Existence of God is a collection of short essays that tackles the biggest question of all. Does God exist? The book is well-researched, easy to read, and now a bestseller on Amazon. Former White House aide Wallace Henley says, I've taught apologetics for many years. Of all the books on apologetics, Simmons is the best I've ever read. If you want to challenge yourself to spiritual and intellectual growth, I encourage you right now to get your copy of Reflections on the Existence of God by Richard Simmons III. Visit reflectionsdinesh.com to learn more about the book and get access to the first chapter for free. Go to reflectionsdinesh.com now. That's reflectionsdinesh.com. A top aide in Governor Cuomo's administration in New York now admits that they have been cooking the books on deaths, the data on deaths in nursing homes. So not only have they been sending people to their deaths, but they have now been, you may say, covering up the body count. This is deeply shocking because it's coming at a time in an epidemic when we're supposed to be trusting the health authorities, trusting the data that they put out. And now we hear from the secretary to the governor, Melissa DeRosa. She's in a phone call with Democrats in New York, and she apologizes that they have been hiding the data. Now, evidently, this was by several thousand people. And what's interesting is the reason that she gives for hiding the data. A reason is not that they're sorry about the fact that they misled families, they added to people's trauma, they made decisions that caused people to die. No, their argument is that they made things politically uncomfortable for Democrats. So she basically says that the reason they did this was because they were scared of Trump. She says that Trump was tweeting about the responsibility in the blue states. He was going after Governor Whitmer. Her argument appears to be that we froze, to quote Melissa DeRosa, we froze and we didn't want to give ammunition basically to the feds. Wow. Now, first of all, this could very well be a serious crime. There needs to be an investigation of it. But it also raises a couple of things. First of all, the lavish praise that so many people in the media and elsewhere were lavishing on Cuomo. In fact, contrasting him with Trump as if Cuomo is following the science and Trump is not. Listen.
David, we're sitting by for Governor Cuomo's press conference, his daily briefing. How would you contrast Cuomo and President Trump's handling of the crisis?
Truth versus mendacity. Governor Cuomo out there day after day after day. Everything Trump isn't. Honest, direct, brave.
Real leadership of the kind the President of the United States should have provided.
Governor Cuomo is clearly living in a totally different reality, the actual one, than the President of the United States.
Governor Cuomo has become a national leader.
For a lot of people, Andrew Cuomo has become the leader of the Democratic Party.
So these are the liberals, the familiar toadies. But ironically, it's even some conservatives who were praising Cuomo. Here's Peggy Noonan. Our governor is a folk hero. Cuomo has the latest, most pertinent information, and he knew a month ago what a ventilator is. He prioritizes problems, has command of the subject matter, is human, eloquent, tireless. This is Peggy in her kind of familiar worship mode, but it started out with Reagan, and now it's ended up with this disgusting Cuomo. Quite a fall. The point here is this. This was done. This crime was apparently committed to avoid the feds going after New York. And yet, when you actually look at it, look more closely, you realize that even that is a lie. Even that is a lie. Why? Because Trump tweeted for the first time about Cuomo and the nursing homes on the 3rd of September, 2020. But New York had been suppressing the nursing home data for months before that. In fact, there was a legislative hearing August 3rd in New York. They suppressed the data then. There were Freedom of Information Act requests long before that. Those were resisted and blocked. So the bottom line of it is, even this so-called pretext for hiding the information, the big bad Trump is going to go after us, even that turns out to be deceitful. So deceit upon deceit upon deceit. Where is the FBI? Where is the DOJ? Where are the handcuffs when we need them? I'm very proud right now to be one of the top MyPillow salesmen in the country, not because that was always my childhood dream, but because I think it's critically important that we support Mike Lindell and MyPillow. This is a guy who has been, I think, second to Trump under withering leftist attack. Let me just read a list of stores that have dropped MyPillow, and I won't even name all of them. Dollar General, Mattress Firm, Kohl's, Kroger, BJ's, Wayfair, Bed Bath & Beyond, Affirm, HEB, Finger Hut, Kinney Drugs, Colony Brands, Bluestream, JCP. This is outrageous. We've got to support Mike. We've got to actually make sure that Mike comes out on top. And the good thing is Mike has incredible products. That's why all these stores were carrying them and actually being very successful with them. Mike is offering buy one, get one on his amazing Giza Dream Sheets. He's found the best cotton in the world in a region where the Sahara Desert, the Nile River, and the Mediterranean Sea all come together to create the ideal weather conditions for growing cotton. His new Giza Dream Bed Sheets are made with this long staple cotton. Mike guarantees they'll be the most comfortable sheets you ever own. The first night you sleep on them, you'll never want to sleep on anything else. The Giza Dream Sheets are available in a whole bunch of colors, and like all of Mike's products, they come with a 60-day money-back guarantee and a 10-year warranty. Right now, you can buy one, get one free by calling 800-876-0227 and use promo code Dinesh. For a limited time, buy one, get one free, call 800-876-0227 or go to MyPillow.com. There's a whole bunch of products there. You'll get deep discounts on all of them. Just make sure to use promo code Dinesh. Ooh la la, the French of all people are coming out against the woke culture of American leftism. They are specifically denouncing the progressive left in America, and they are saying they want none of that in France. And this is coming from Emmanuel Macron, the progressive head of France. It's coming from a guy who would normally be expected to be sympathetic to all this. But American-style leftism, he says, is, quote, splitting France in two. And this isn't just Macron. His education minister has essentially denounced the influence of leftism in American universities, which he says is now being reverberating or being echoed in France. And he says American universities are providing, quote, a justification for terrorism. This may seem like a huge surprise. And the French are kind of hard to predict. I admit, I've experienced it. Many years ago, I was given an award, a prize for helping to promote intellectual freedom in the aftermath of my book, Illiberal Education. And because the prize was $10,000, I went to France to collect it. And I gave a speech talking about this crazy stuff going on in American universities. By the way, the same woke leftism that I saw a whole generation ago, but then it was confined to the campus. And what's funny is that the French would, as I was speaking, they would just kind of laugh, hee, 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 hee. And initially I thought they were agreeing with me. They agreed with me that this leftism was dangerous. But what's funny is that they interpreted this as essentially a sign of American immaturity. Hee, 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 these silly Americans, look at all the nonsense they talk about. I got the idea that in France they look at Americans, adult Americans, as grown-up children. And that was the, this is why they loved the stuff in Illiberal Education, because to them it wasn't a reflection of the craziness of the American campus, but the craziness of Americans themselves. So sometimes the French take things a whole other way. But on a more serious note, and now, there have been a series of horrific Islamic murders in France. Let me talk about a couple of them. A secondary school teacher had his head cut off by a man, in a sense, shouting Allahu Akbar. Three people were recently stabbed to death in a church. The perpetrators were Muslims who said they were doing it because of their religion. Now, you can just imagine France taking all this into account and then listening to the American left's, we have to warn against the rising tide of global Islamophobia. No, the problem isn't Islamophobia. The problem is that you've got these gruesome people doing horrific things in the name of their religion. Here's Gilles Kipel, a world-famous student of Islam. And Kipel says that American influence has led to, quote, a prohibition in universities to think about the phenomenon of political Islam in the name of a leftist ideology that considers it the religion of the underprivileged. So by making Islam into a victim, you can't talk about the way in which political Islam does monstrous things in the name of religion. But there's a broader point here that Macron is getting at, which I think is worth thinking about. And that is not just that you've got this kind of American intellectual Taliban making leftist excuses for Islamic terrorism. But more broadly, you've got this ideology of racial separatism that contradicts the fundamental idea of France. This is something that the French education minister has been all over, and so has Macron. He talks about a national identity based upon French values. The very old French idea going back to the Enlightenment and the idea of the French Revolution was the idea that if you become French, and what that means is you embrace French culture and you speak French, that is the only way to be French. There are not multiple ways to be French, there's only one, and that is you embrace French culture and you speak the French language. So the French, for example, don't even keep racial statistics. They don't count how many blacks and browns and whites there are. Why? Because all those people are Frenchmen and French women. It's a universalist ideal, and they're holding to it. And what they see is they see this balkanization in America. America is literally splitting up into these balkanized enclaves, and they don't want it. So their message to America is keep these sick, demented ideas to yourself. We want none of it in France. And I think in this respect, we actually may have surprisingly something to learn from the French. Once in a very long while, as with croissants and escargot, the French do get something right. Do you think there's a coincidence between Biden signing over 40 executive orders in his first couple of weeks and the price of silver skyrocketing? No, no coincidence. Savvy investors know that precious metals are a hedge against inflation and government stupidity. And Birch Gold Group is not only your headquarters for gold, but silver too. If you want to purchase physical gold or silver drop shipped straight to your door, or help converting an IRA or eligible 401k into an IRA backed by gold and silver, Birch Gold Group is your solution. They are the premier precious metals IRA company in America with an A+ Better Business Bureau rating, countless 5-star reviews, and thousands of satisfied customers. And guess what? I'm one of them. There's a tidal wave of inflation coming. Gold and silver are your hedge. Text Dinesh to 484848 for your free information kit on a precious metals IRA, or to speak with a Birch Gold representative today. Time is running out, but you can protect your savings now. Text Dinesh to 484848. There's a remarkable story that is coming out involving Twitter and the government of India. The people at Twitter have essentially now colluded with the government of India to suppress a whole bunch of Twitter accounts of Indians who are fighting against the government because of the so-called farm crisis. There are widespread farmer protests across India. It has to do with the government regulating the prices of farm goods. And thus denying the rights of the farmers to sell on the open market. Now, the government has all kinds of pretexts for this. It's COVID. We're trying to streamline the supply, make sure all the Indians get food, blah, blah, blah. But the bottom line is the farmers are angry. The farmers are protesting. And Twitter has decided to come in on the side of the government to shut down voices of dissent. Here's a news clip talking about that.
Twitter has finally been forced to permanently suspend a few of the accounts that the Indian government had requested that they need to be suspended. Now, in the block, Twitter has said that it has now suspended more than 500 accounts. It responded to the Indian government's order to remove over 1,000 accounts for what the Indian government claims is spreading misinformation in connection with the farmers' protests.
So what's going on here? Now, I first, oddly enough, learned about this story because of something I saw about Greta Thunberg. This is the Scandinavian kid who's been active on the climate change issue, but she's apparently trying to become kind of a global activist, including on many topics she knows nothing about. So Greta Thunberg put out a tweet on the side of the farmers in India, but it turned out that the tweet wasn't even thought of by her. She was being fed the tweet by some left-wing activist organization that literally supplied it to her and said, here's what you tweet. And Thunberg foolishly not only put out her own tweet, but put out the message from the other group telling her what to tweet. In other words, making it obvious that she's merely a conduit. So the Indian government jumped all over it and said, hey, here's an international conspiracy to go against the Indian government. We're going to begin a criminal investigation of Greta Thunberg. So that's how this all got started. Now, what was happening was the Indian government sat down with Twitter and basically said, we've got all these dissenters and protesters, and they are putting out misinformation, just like in America. And we've noticed that you, Twitter, in America have been shutting down accounts for putting out misinformation. Well, why don't you do it for us? Is it just because we're brown? Is it just because we're minorities? Does India not matter? Don't you care about misinformation here? And Twitter was like, yeah, of course we do. Of course we do. What can we do to help you? So Twitter now, basically you could say, has now become a global big brother, is globally working in tandem with governments to shut down free speech. They're not just shutting down our free speech in America. They evidently want to shut down the free speech now of farmers and farm activists in India. So this is taking tyranny onto the global scale. I mean, just think of it. Think of how horrific it is that these platforms have become global censors, working in the hands with bullying governments and tyrannical states, people who are trying to shut down. And they've been doing it around the world for all kinds of reasons and for many, many years. But to see these American companies now become the mechanism of them carrying out this censorship, I think it really begins to show how the American presence in the world in these important respects is now not on the side of freedom, but on the side of tyranny. Want to belong to a senior organization you can trust? That's AMAC, the Association of Mature American Citizens. AMAC is the fastest growing conservative 50-plus organization in America. Over 2 million people have joined and now carry the AMAC membership card. AMAC was built by folks who feel the same way we do. AMAC stands up for the values that have made America great: faith, family, and freedom. They believe in the sanctity of our Constitution, including the First and Second Amendments. They're fighting against the ever-expanding scope of the federal government. They're pro-small business, secure borders, support our military, and respect our veterans. AMAC works hard to deliver real value to their members, providing the best benefits, discounts, and services you can find in one place. Join AMAC today. Debbie and I are lifetime members. Go to amac.us and join now. The website again is amac.us. It's always really fun for me to have my daughter, Danielle D'Souza Gill, on the podcast. I feel like I'm talking to a smarter version of myself. Dee, welcome to the podcast. I'm kind of chuckling because I notice your book, The Choice, strategically placed in the background so everyone can see it. Is that a kind of a marketing move on your part?
Oh, yeah. Very strategic marketing move. Had to talk to some, you know, big consulting agencies to get this idea right here.
Never been done before. That's what I find so innovative about it. It's really cold here in Texas. We're getting ready for a bit of a freeze, and everybody is freaking out because they're just not used to it. So has it been cold right there on the East Coast?
It is pretty cold up here. Yes, we're a little more used to it. So definitely stay warm in Texas.
Yeah, I think that's the key. Hey, I wanted to talk to you about a couple of things. I'll start with Nikki Haley, because I was interested to see today that in an interview that she did with Politico, she made the statement that we were wrong to, quote, follow Trump. It seemed to be a little bit of a repudiation of Nikki Haley not only serving in the Trump administration, but it's almost as if she's saying, I'm having second thoughts. Not just that the Republican Party needs to find a new path forward, but we were on the wrong path before. Now, it threw my mind back to the fact that you were pretty recently, I mean, during the campaign, I believe, at an event with Nikki Haley. What was the event, and tell us what your impression was then?
Yeah, I did a lot of events with the Trump campaign, did a lot of traveling on the Women for Trump bus tour, which was awesome, meeting people all over the country, trying to talk to them about President Trump and all of his accomplishments. So that was awesome. On one of my stops, we were in Pennsylvania. We were doing an Indian Voices for Trump event, and Nikki Haley was the speaker there. I did an opening prayer, and I was just kind of listening to her speech. And I guess what stuck out to me was the fact that she kept emphasizing the fact that she worked so much with Trump. She had a seat at the table. She had so much influence because Trump believed in her. And that was kind of her focus in that talk. So it surprised me to see her criticizing him, not because I didn't realize that she had maybe always had these tendencies of being more of a Bush style Republican. I think we kind of saw those tendencies in her before, but it seemed like she actually came out, you know, verbally attacking Trump now. And I just really, really don't like it.
Well, you made a startling statement to me earlier today. You said that even after January 6th, Nikki Haley was tweeting in favor of Trump, talking about Trump's record, Trump's accomplishments. So it wasn't that she was for Trump, then this was an unbelievably traumatic event, January 6th. She was forced to reconsider, because you said that after January 6th, Nikki Haley, as far as you could see from her own Twitter, was still pro-Trump, right?
Yeah, I was looking back on her Twitter account and I saw that she, I think Fox News, it was a Fox News clip that she had tweeted out about how she talked about how she was in favor of Trump's accomplishments over the last 4 years. And she thinks that we shouldn't kind of let those go. And this was even after the January 6th situation. So I guess just to see her now try to knock him when he's down, so to speak, in the middle of impeachment is just, I don't know, just a low blow.
Well, I think that two things are striking. One is she did an interview with what's clearly a left-wing publication, Politico. So it appears that some of it is courting the left. And the other thing is the timing of it, because it would appear that this was strategically timed to maybe try to convince some Republican senators to vote to convict Trump. It's either very unfortunate timing or it appears to be very deliberate and strategic timing on her part. But I think both things don't seem to bode very well for her own future in the leadership of the Republican Party. What do you think?
Definitely not. I mean, it kind of just comes across like she was riding Trump's coattails when Trump was super popular. I think he still is. But now that she, from her perspective, thinks he maybe isn't as much, she's decided to jump ship. And maybe she sees this as beneficial for her potential 2024 run. But I think it just shows her true ideology and the fact that she never really believed in a lot of what Trump did, but kind of wanted to get the benefit of it. So I think that's just one of the worst things about politicians. It's like, I just want to know what you believe. If you don't believe that, then just say that and stick by your views. But I think the flip-flopping is just really unpleasant.
Well, it might be revealing that opportunism is her true ideology. Let me turn to another topic. Here's a quotation from Norman Ornstein. Norman Ornstein is an old geezer who was a colleague of mine at AEI. He's now kind of a never-Trumper. And he's bashing Marjorie Taylor Greene. And here's his statement. Marjorie Taylor Greene says abortion is, quote, the worst thing this country has ever committed. And then he sarcastically adds, Norman Ornstein does, Native Americans and descendants of slaves would like a word with her. So his implication appears to be that the condition of the Native Americans and the descendant, not even the slaves, but the descendants of slaves is far worse than that of the unborn. I want to talk about a theme that you talk about in The Choice, right there, a book people should get, where you talk about how abortion is the worst form of mass killing occurring now in America and in the world. Say a word about that.
Yeah, well, if we think about it, abortion is really just on the numbers, it's the greatest mass killing. There were 61 million abortions in America alone since Roe v. Wade. And if we look at on a global scale, for example, in 2018, abortion took more lives than cancer, terrorism, HIV, all of these other things, which are horrible. But abortion, it's the greatest form of mass killing. And even if we just look at this act of abortion, it is killing someone who's completely helpless and completely trapped in the womb. The womb that's supposed to be the safest place becomes kind of a terrorist chamber for torture.
Now, if I do the math, and I'm going to do a sort of macabre math here, there were slaves, 4 million slaves was the kind of peak moment of slavery in 1860. So that was the maximum number of slaves in the United States at any one time. But of course, the slaves weren't killed. They were enslaved. Their life was, in a sense, became the property of the master. Their liberty became the property of the master. Now, the Native Americans died in large numbers. They weren't killed deliberately for the most part. They died by disease. And while tens of millions of them died, this was over a period of centuries. So if you look, for example, at the rate of Native American deaths per year, it completely pales before the abortion numbers. 61 million, if I just do the math, it's about 50 years since Roe versus Wade. That's a million casualties a year. So I think what's going on with Norm Ornstein is he's got a hidden assumption. His hidden assumption is that the unborn are not human, but the Native Americans and the slaves are. And that's why what Marjorie Taylor Greene says is offensive to him. Obviously, Marjorie Taylor Greene's assumption is that the unborn are human. Now, commenting on this thread, somebody goes, you're making a metaphysical assumption. You know, Native Americans, unlike Native Americans and African Americans, whose consciousness is empirically demonstrable. So this is one of Norm Ornstein's fans who seems to be saying that Native Americans and blacks have consciousness, but the unborn don't. Is there any evidence that the unborn are conscious?
I guess I would just first start by responding by saying that abortion actually takes more lives of minority babies than white babies. More black babies are aborted than white babies in many cities. If we look at the percentage in the country, it doesn't align with the population. So actually, this idea that abortion is somehow completely unrelated from the race issue is false. It's completely related, and it's decimating minority communities across the country. And Margaret Sanger, who founded Planned Parenthood, she had the goal of getting rid of human weeds and using this as a form of eugenics and population control. And so I would say that first. But I think secondly, the fact that you mentioned consciousness and how, you know, these lives in the womb don't have the same consciousness as someone else. Well, I would say that we all started in the womb, and we actually do know that the child in the womb has consciousness in the sense that even when they have an object coming towards them, such as the suction for an abortion, they try to get away from it. We can see that in the ultrasound. They try to avoid, you know, being stabbed by this item, being attacked, being suctioned. And we also know that even just about 10 weeks in, when a woman gets an abortion, the abortionist has to crush with a metal device a specific object called the brain. We even know that its neurons are already developing. We know that, for example, doctors even perform neurosurgery on premature babies and babies in the womb. So their brains are so similar to ours, to the fact that they can have very advanced neurosurgery. So I think this idea that they're not like us, they're not human, it's scientifically untrue. They are human. And then the left usually dives into, well, how advanced is their cognition? How much memory do they have? How smart are they? And so on, and compare them to a comatose person, for example, to which I would say that actually they have a lot more vital signs than a comatose person, number one, because we see these vital signs of not only brain waves, but reactions to pain. And many who are comatose don't feel that. Now, that obviously doesn't take away their personhood. But I think that to kind of act as though the child in the womb doesn't have any consciousness is incorrect.
I mean, what I find so tragic is it's a strategy of dehumanization of the unborn. And that's exactly the same strategy that was used against Native Americans, against blacks, against other vulnerable populations to justify extermination. Hey, Danielle, thanks for coming on as always. And I look forward to having you back soon.
Thank you.
Cybercrime is up 75%, and by far the most serious cybercrime to worry about is home title theft. The job of the criminals is easier than you think. The title documents to our homes are now online. The thief finds your home's title and forges your signature on a quitclaim deed stating you sold your home to him. Then he takes out loans on your home and leaves you in debt. You won't know until late payment or eviction notices arrive, insurance doesn't cover you, and neither do common identity theft programs. That's why I protect my home with Home Title Lock. The instant Home Title Lock detects someone tampering with my home's title, they help shut it down. Go to HometitleLock.com and register your address to see if you're already a victim. Then use code RADIO to receive 30 free days of protection. That's code RADIO at HometitleLock.com, HometitleLock.com. It's time for the mailbox, and we have a very interesting audio question on religious freedom.
Hi, my name is Morgan. How does the U.S. balance freedom of religion while also pursuing to be a Judeo-Christian nation at the same time as having citizens who have other beliefs or even atheists?
This is a very interesting question because what he's saying is that we are simultaneously a Judeo-Christian nation, a nation founded on certain principles. And yet, we want to be a nation that has religious freedom, that's open to people of different beliefs, differing religious beliefs or no religious beliefs at all. And how do you reconcile those two things? How do you, in his words, balance them? Morgan wants to know. Well, the good thing is, I don't think there's any balancing involved at all. And here's what I mean. The moral and political and philosophical and economic foundation of our country is built on Judaism and Christianity. now, not only on Judaism and Christianity. It's built on the foundation of, I would say, Athens and Jerusalem. And Athens here refers to classical reason, and Jerusalem refers to Judaism and to Christianity. So all those elements come together. And what that means is that is the moral root of America. Think of something like Jefferson saying, all men are created equal. Well, we're equal not because we look equal, or we're equally fast, or equally smart, or even equal in moral character. We're created equal. We're equal in the eyes of God. So that theological truth is the foundation for a political lesson, which is that the state, the government, should treat us equally as citizens. So that's the way in which a Judeo-Christian foundation plays out. Now, the idea that we're created equal, that laws apply equally, laws obviously don't just apply equally to Christians. They don't just apply equally to Christians and Jews. They apply equally to everyone. So there is no inconsistency whatever in saying that our country is built on a Christian foundation. It would be almost inconceivable without it. And saying that in this Christian republic, if you will, we respect religious freedom. Let's remember that religious freedom is a doctrine of Christianity itself. Right in the Garden of Eden, God gives Adam and Eve the power to choose, which is to say, the power to reject him, no less than the power to follow his edicts. So religious freedom is not some principle kind of alien to Christianity that has to be balanced against it. Religious freedom is a principle inside of Christianity itself, and that's why we can be a tolerant society, a free society, a society that allows not just free speech, but freedom of conscience. The most important thing is not even to necessarily today to figure out how to reconcile those principles, but to stand up for them at a time when they are under severe attack.
Subscribe to the Dinesh D'Souza podcast on Apple, Google, and Spotify, or watch on Rumble, YouTube, and SalemNow.com.